D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Mit Katrin Ohlendorf. Hallo. So, jetzt mal anschnallen. Im Hörsaal geht es heute um Sex. Natürlich alles rein wissenschaftlich. Sex und Sexualität, beziehungsweise die Art, was in Sachen Sex und Sexualität als Norm und Normal gilt, bestimmt nämlich ziemlich grundlegend unser Zusammenleben und unsere Gesellschaftsstrukturen. Beispiel Frauenbild. Männer, so jedenfalls die gängige Sichtweise, sind darauf programmiert, ihr Erbgut möglichst breit zu streuen, während Frauen auf Versorgung und Sicherheit aus sind. Sie tauschen sozusagen Sex gegen bestimmte Güter und Dienstleistungen, wie zum Beispiel Nahrung oder Schutz. Darwin sagt, deine Mutter ist eine Hure. Dieses zugegebenermaßen ziemlich zugespitzte Zitat stammt nicht von mir, sondern von Christopher Ryan und Cecilia Jetta. Formuliert haben sie das in ihrem Buch Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality, also frei übersetzt Sex in der Frühzeit, die prähistorischen Ursprünge moderner Sexualität. Dieser Satz wird gleich im Vortrag auch noch näher erklärt. Mit dem Buch haben sie in den USA für ziemliches Aufsehen gesorgt, denn sie versuchen damit nichts Geringeres, als mit dieser ihrer Ansicht nach falschen Lesart der menschlichen Natur aufzuräumen und damit gleichzeitig auch mit der überwiegend in der Welt verbreiteten Ansicht, Monogamie sei evolutionär logisch und begründet. Christopher Ryan hat Eckpunkte aus Sex at Dawn im Einstein Forum Potsdam vorgestellt, und zwar in einem Vortrag am 28. November 2012, auf Englisch und sehr unterhaltsam, gespickt mit Beispielen aus der Geschichte und aus der Tierwelt, zum Beispiel von unseren nahen Verwandten, den Bonobos. Gleich hören wir diesen Vortrag, vorher nur kurz ein paar Worte zu den Autoren. Christopher Ryan ist Literaturwissenschaftler, Psychologe und Autor, und sein besonderes Interesse gilt der Frage, welche menschlichen Eigenschaften von der Natur vorgegeben und welche kulturell bedingt sind. Seine Doktorarbeit, die Grundlage von Sex at Dawn, dreht sich um die prähistorischen Wurzeln menschlicher Sexualität. Cecilia Jetta hat eine medizinische Ausbildung und sie war genauso wie Ryan ziemlich viel in der Welt unterwegs. Unter anderem hat sie für die Weltgesundheitsorganisation über Sexualverhalten im ländlichen Mosambik geforscht, das Ziel dabei, eine effektivere AIDS-Prävention zu schaffen. Heute arbeitet sie als Psychiaterin in Spanien. Das in aller Kürze. Die Wissenschaftsjournalistin und Psychologin Fanny Jiménez hat Ryan und sein Buch im Einstein-Forum noch etwas detaillierter vorgestellt und diese Einführung hören wir gleich vorab. Eine kleine Anmerkung noch. Ryan zeigt in seinem Vortrag ein kurzes Video. Das haben wir einfach ausgeblendet, weil wir natürlich nicht sehen können. Er erklärt danach aber, was zu sehen war. Also viel Spaß mit Sex at Dawn.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think it's an enormously interesting topic and I'm really looking forward to the discussion. A few words about Christopher Ryan. He's a psychologist, an author and also a teacher. He received his bachelor's degree in English and American literature in 1984, and a master's degree and a PhD in psychology from Saybrook University in San Francisco in California, 20 years later. In his doctoral dissertation, he analyzed the prehistoric roots of human sexuality, so the topic we will talk about today, and he especially focused on trying to distinguish what is innately human and what is culturally founded. The time between those two degrees, he spent traveling around the world and working at very different and sometimes slightly odd jobs, like gutting salmon in Alaska or teaching English to prostitutes in Bangkok or self-defense to land reform activists in Mexico. So very interesting job career. But he has also lectured at the University of the Barcelona Medical School. He consulted at various hospitals and he contributed to a variety of academic publications and has been in the media quite a lot. He's been featured on the national media in the United States, for example, on MSNBC, CNN, the Washington Post, The Time, but also in international newspapers. Christopher Ryan also contributes to both Psychology Today, which is an internet website about psychological topics, and the Huffington Post. The book that we will talk about today, Sex at Dawn, was published in 2010, and it entered the New York Times bestseller list pretty much right away, 1 month after the publication. The book was co-written with his wife, Casilda, and it received considerable recognition. It was one of NPR's favorite books of 2010. It won the Consumer Book Award by the Society for Sex Therapy and Research. It was chosen as one of the best science and technology books of 2010 by Audible.com. And it also received the Iron Harriet Rice Theory Award from the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality. So what is the book about? I don't want to tell you too much already, but it's just a little bit of the storyline. So the authors argue that human beings evolved in a little egalitarian hunter-gatherer bands in which sex or sexual interaction was a communal and a shared resource, so much like food or any goods, defense for the group, taking care of children. And the idea behind it is that property was communal, so there was no like individual goods that people inherited or gave to their kids. It was all communal. And with that comes the idea that also the issue of paternity was communal. It was not so important to know whose child it was that was born. And this assumption of paternity being communal does question the standard narrative of evolutionary psychology, which states that securing paternity is really a main concern for males. In the book, Ryan and his wife demonstrate the consequences of these basic assumptions that differ from the standard scientific view. And they argue that much of evolutionary psychology has been conducted with a certain bias regarding human sexuality. They call this the Flintonization of the hunter-gatherer society. And it means that we tend, from our perspective of the world as it is today, of our modern assumptions and views, we tend to project those assumptions onto earlier cultures and assume that what we find there is inherently or innate nature. With it comes the thought that there has been a bias assuming that our species is primarily monogamous, despite what they believe to be evidence of the contrary. And they draw on evidence from a wide area of disciplines such as anthropology, archaeology, psychosexuality, anatomy, and suggest that the selection of a mate in early human history was not so much the subject of a competition between humans in this group, at least not until the agricultural change came, which is the point when they say property developed, and with the development of property and taking care of what belongs to me and you, also the thought of paternity and the thought of who is my child and who is not developed. What I think is really interesting throughout the book is that the authors don't really take an explicit position on what to do with these findings. They say themselves, we don't really know what to do with our ideas ourselves, and it's open to debate, but they emphasize that it's really important to be aware of human history, of how sexual behaviors may have developed. And as a science editor, this is interesting because I think in the past 2 years or so, there's been many articles on romantic ideals, the question of monogamy, of sexual faithfulness, a lot of articles on the divorce rate and the reasons for divorce rates going up, the issue of serial monogamy, such that people don't have a one lifetime partner, but rather split up every 5 to 10 years, such that people up to the age of 30 have on average 3 sexual partners already. And with those findings that are written down, I think there comes a notion or a mindset that there is a never-ending tension between the need or the wish for attachment, for stable relationships, for home in a way in another person, and sex, which on the other side needs novelty or novel aspects. And I think there's, from my view, really a doubt that monogamy is the one standard way of living sexual relationships. But I think there's also a certain helplessness on what to do with this doubt and how to develop an idea, how to proceed from here. So Yeah, is sexual truthfulness possible? Is it a myth, an ideal, a lie? I'm really looking forward to the discussion, and I would like to hand over to Christopher Ray.
I'm Chris. Casilda is over here in the corner. The main thing I want to go through, or I want to start with, is an admission. I want to be very clear that we do not claim to see a truth that no one else has ever seen, or to be proclaiming any sort of divine wisdom. So some of the ideas that we're talking about aren't, I'm sure a lot of you know, they're not particularly new ideas. Friedrich Engels talked about a lot of this, the development of the nuclear family with the advent of agriculture, private property. These are ideas that have been debated for a long time. Darwin debated these specific ideas with Morgan, who was the first American, and most people would consider him the first American anthropologist, who believed that human beings developed in what he called the primal horde, or promiscuous hordes of people that shared sexual relations and shared childcare. So this question of whether we evolved in nuclear families or in some larger conglomeration goes back to the very beginnings of anthropological debate. To make things a little easier for the book, what we define the standard model, we call the standard model, this narrative, or the standard narrative, that we've all heard relating to the idea that women, since time immemorial, have traded their sexual favors to men in return for goods and services. Whether it be meat, or protection, or status, or shelter, or a nice watch, or whatever, you know, whatever society you're in, there were different things. And so the line we use in the book is we say, Darwin says your mother is a whore. Okay, now we're saying that jokingly, but in the sense that according to this Darwinian view of human sexuality, it's women's nature to trade sex for things, right? Which is essentially what prostitution is. We say, no, your mother has sex because she likes it. Same reason your father has sex. Human beings, we'll get into this a little later, but human beings are very unusual mammals in that we have sex in all sorts of ways that can't possibly result in pregnancy. We have sex when, you know, males of most animals are willing to have sex anytime, but the females aren't. But in our species, the females are willing to have sex when they're already pregnant, when they're ovulating, when they're lactating, when they're postmenopausal. They'll have sex in all sorts of ways that have nothing to do with reproduction. And that's a very unusual thing in the animal kingdom. So just to get through some very basic stuff about where we get the information, there are essentially four primary areas that we look at in the book. Primatology, particularly chimps and bonobos. Now, if your dog is misbehaving and you go to the animal world to try to understand your dog better, you're probably going to look at wolves and coyotes and foxes, right? You're not going to look at elephants and swans and prairie voles. But this is what happens when we talk about human sexuality. You'll find if you read in the popular press or even in scientific literature, a lot of times when the scientists are looking for models to compare to human beings, they'll talk about penguins. I don't know if, did that movie, was that big over here? The March of the Penguins, right. I don't know if that was big in Europe, but in the United States, it was this media extravaganza where churches were renting out theaters for everyone from the congregation to go and see this amazing movie about the monogamous emperor penguins in Antarctica. And it's very moving because they lay their eggs and then they huddle in this big round circle and they take turns who gets to sit on the egg. And the egg sits on their feet, so the egg can't sit on the ice. And then they sort of huddle over the egg. And then they take turns moving to the outside of the circle, who's getting the wind on their back. So it's an interesting, complex sort of system they've got there. And then I think it's the fathers stay with the egg and the mothers trek across the tundra to go fishing, and then they come back with the fish and vomit all the fish up. Anyway, it's this allegory of monogamy, right? What they don't tell you in the movie is that emperor penguins live into their 40s, I believe. They become sexually active at about 12 or 13, And every year they have a different sexual partner. So these emperor penguins have 25, 30 sexual partners in their lives, and yet they're being held up as a, you know, model of monogamy. It's a crazy thing, but it's very common. So what we do in the book is we say, okay, primatology is relevant. We believe it's relevant. Maybe you don't. Maybe other, you know, people say it's not relevant. Fine, you can take that out of the mix, and we still have an argument here. But if you're going to talk about other mammals and use mammal models, look at chimps and bonobos, because they're the most relevant to humans. They're the most closely related to humans. And in fact, they're extremely closely related to humans. If you go to a zoo and you're standing there looking at a chimp or a bonobo, that creature is more closely related to you than it is to any other animal in the zoo. Right? It's more closely related to a human than it is to a gorilla, which is its next closest relative. Now, the way to think about chimps and bonobos are like, I've got twin brothers. Now, those twin brothers are more closely related to each other than they are to me, right? But after each other, I'm their next closest relative. Now, as it turns out, one of my brothers can be kind of vicious. He engages in warfare and rape and murder and all sorts of nastiness. And he's, you know, very hierarchical. That's the chimp. I've got another brother, though, who nobody ever mentions, and that's the bonobo. And the reason nobody mentions the bonobo, have you all heard of bonobos?
Yes.
Yes, okay, good. Well, you'll certainly hear from Franz de Waal. He's responsible for bringing bonobos very much into mainstream thought. Before him, he tells a great story about, I think it was an American show, Nova, I think it was, that talked to him. They wanted to do a story about bonobos, and they sent a camera crew to Congo, where they live, and they went out and they were filming bonobos. And the thing about bonobos is they're very peaceful, that no one has ever witnessed a bonobo killing or raping another bonobo, ever, in 40 years of research, in the wild and in captivity. But the reason they're not mentioned is because they're embarrassing. They have sex all the time, right? So everyone wants to talk about the chimps because they have war, and we've all heard Jane Goodall talk about the war between the different chimps and the rapes and the murders and all this crazy stuff. But we don't hear much about bonobos because none of that drama happens. There's still hierarchies, there's still power interplays and things like that, but they never reach the point where somebody gets fatally injured. And it's a female-dominated society, which tells you why males might not want to talk about it too much. And they're always having sex. If you throw some food into an enclosure of chimpanzees, all hell breaks loose. They fight, and then the dominant males will take control of the food, and maybe they share a little bit with their coalition partners. And if there's a female who happens to be ovulating, maybe she'll get some. But it's a very sort of Machiavellian world in chimpanzees. If you throw a bunch of food into an enclosure of bonobos, they all have sex, and then they share the food. So my point is, in case you're wondering, if you're going to talk about primate origins of warfare, of sexuality, of family structure, of whatever, it's incumbent upon you to talk about chimpanzees and bonobos. When you read any report about the primate origins of blah, 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 and they only mention chimps, that's not scientifically valid. That's a dishonest report, in my opinion. So that's, I think, a very important thing. Anyway, so anthropology, we look at particularly hunter-gatherer societies which are generally thought to be living more or less the way our distant ancestors lived, who were also hunter-gatherers, particularly immediate return hunter-gatherers, which means that they don't have any accumulated food. They find it, they eat it, and they move on the next day. This is an important distinction. We look at contemporary psychosexual research, a lot of which is done at the Max Planck Institute. Every third paper I read seems to come from there. And comparative primate anatomy, which I'll be talking about today. Today I'm focused mainly on the primates and the comparative primate anatomy. I hope no one's easily offended by discussions of testicles and things like that.
This is Europe.
This is Europe. Even better, it's Berlin. Yes. Now, I mentioned earlier that these ideas we present in the book aren't particularly new ideas, but what we're doing is revisiting, as Dominic said, we're revisiting some of these debates, the Hobbes-Rousseau debate, which goes back centuries, with new data, sources of information that weren't available until recently. But this is a quote from Edwin O. Wilson, who's probably the most famous living biologist. This is from 1976, I think, where he says that everything we can surmise of humankind's genetic history argues for a more liberal sexual morality in which sexual practices are to be regarded first as bonding devices and only second as a means for procreation. That's essentially what we're saying in our book. We're saying that human sexuality, the primary function of human sexuality, is to establish trust and intimacy. And that this was essential to the functioning of a small band of hunter-gatherers in the primordial environment, this intimacy and trust. Not only one particular pair bond, but trust and intimacy throughout the group, because everyone was interdependent with everyone else. You know, we mentioned Flintstonization. I don't know if the Flintstones was a popular show in Germany. Yeah. So the Flintstones, you know, the song, I don't know if they translated it accurately, but they sing the meet the Flintstones. It's the modern Stone Age family. Modern Stone Age family, right? That's what we do. We take the modern world, we project it into the Stone Age, and we say, well, they must have been more or less like us, right? They were just like us. They lived in little nuclear families. They had cars, but you had to pedal with your feet. You know, they had the bird instead of the doorbell. That's not, it's a lack of imagination. We're not understanding how radically different life was for our ancestors. Okay, so let's get into the bonobo social life a little bit. We all know about chimps, so today I'm going to talk more about bonobos. Unlike chimps, which are male-dominated species, bonobos are female-centered. Now, Franz de Waal said that it's not even really accurate to use the word hierarchy when talking about the ranking system in bonobos, because the bonobo society is dominated by females, and there is a hierarchy among the females, but the females' rank in that hierarchy is not based upon coercive power. It's based upon how loved and respected she is by the other females. You see, it's not who's the biggest, strongest. Among chimps, it's about being big, strong, fierce, clever, right? It's a very greedy, yeah, exactly. Quick to violence, right? It's just like a street gang or something. Whereas with bonobos, it's dominated by females, but the highest ranking females are only high ranking because everybody else loves them. Not because they're giving anyone a hard time or they're stealing food or they're coercing other bonobos. Now, female bonobos are about 15 to 20% smaller than male bonobos, which, as we'll see, is the same ratio, that's called body size dimorphism, is about the same ratio as with chimpanzees and humans. So if female bonobos are smaller than males, how is it that they dominate the males? Well, what happens is, if a male harasses a female, all the other females will bond together and go after that male. So there's female unity, right? Sister power. And the other thing that works in their favor is that there's so much sexual activity going on that the males never get that frustrated and angry, right? If they're having all that sex, they're pretty happy. They're not raising any problems. So it's a low stress, high sex lifestyle. It's very much a sharing based, as I said, as we'll see with the food. As I also said, there's never been a case of infanticide or murder, and there is no sexually exclusive pair bonding. Now, this is an important point. There is no sexually exclusive pair bonding, but this is not to say that there aren't profound, unique, very meaningful relationships. And this is a point I'll come back to again and again tonight. We're not at all arguing that our ancestors didn't pair bond. We're just saying those pair bonds weren't necessarily sexually exclusive when they occurred. And we're also not saying that our ancestors, when we say our ancestors were sexually promiscuous, we don't mean that in the modern sense, right? Because in the modern sense of promiscuity is you go out to a bar, you meet someone you've never seen before, and you're having sex with them that night, and then you never see them again. That scenario was not possible 10,000 years ago. There were very few strangers around 10, 20, 30,000 years ago, right? So we're saying our ancestors lived in these groups of 100, 150 people, and they probably had lots of ongoing sexual relationships within this group, but none of those people were strangers. None of this was cold, unfeeling, distant sex, right? These were all people that had known each other most of their lives. They, you know, take care of each other's kids. The men go hunting together. The women are cooking together and gathering together. They're spending all their time together. So it's, again, Flintstonization. People apply modern principles when we're talking about these things. We use the word promiscuous and promiscuity because we couldn't find anything better. You know, if you look at the synonyms to promiscuity, they're even worse. So now, bonobo sexuality is very interesting. Unlike chimps, bonobos have sex face to face. They look into each other's eyes. They hold hands. They kiss each other's feet and fingers. They have sex in all possible combinations except mother-son, interestingly. And the mother-son relationship is probably the most important relationship in bonobo societies. In fact, I mentioned earlier, there's a female hierarchy and a male hierarchy. The female's position in the hierarchy seems to be based on how much love and admiration she receives from the other females. The male's position on the male hierarchy is directly tied to where his mother is or was on the female hierarchy. It has nothing to do with how strong he is or how tough or whatever. It's where his mother, how respected his mother is or was if she's no longer alive. Very interesting. And that's the only combination that doesn't have sex. There's male-male sex, female-female sex, brother-sister, father-daughter, whatever, just no mother-son. Oh, the male-male sex is called penis fencing. So you can imagine, right? The female sex is called GG rubbing, genital rubbing. What happens is the two females come up and like back up to each other and then just go like a little James Brown move. And bonobo sex is not necessarily to orgasm, right? In fact, one author described bonobo sexuality as a bonobo handshake. It's just a, hi, how are you? It's just a couple of seconds, you know, it's not, you'll see, we're gonna be watching bonobo porn here in a few minutes. So you'll see what I mean. It's an antidote to stress and conflict. As I said, if you throw some food into an enclosure, they all have sex and then they share the food because that food creates stress. Anything that could cause possible conflict is stressful. So if there's a loud noise, they have sex. Bonobos are very susceptible to noise, actually. I just thought of a story. Again, I think it's Franz Duval who tells this story in Dresden. During the bombing of Dresden, there was a zoo that wasn't directly hit by any of the bombs, but some bombs fell nearby. All the bonobos died from the noise, the trauma. None of the chimps did. So when people came to the zoo, they found all the chimps alive, all the bonobos dead, just from the noise. Okay, and this is an important point, extended receptivity. This is just a scientific phrase that means that the females are willing to have sex not only when they're ovulating. Most animals, as I mentioned earlier, the female only has sex when she's ovulating. Humans are almost unique in that they'll have sex anytime. Bonobos have sex about 80% of their cycle. Chimps about 40 to 50% of the cycle. Anyone know the other mammal that has sex 100% of its cycle? Dolphins. Now think about that. You've got chimps, humans, bonobos, dolphins. Those are the four major exceptions to the rule of having sex only for reproductive purposes. They're all highly intelligent, highly social animals, and sex fulfills a social function for all of them. So, okay, I promised you some bonobo porn. Here you go. This was filmed in the Congo in a bonobo rehabilitation center there, and they've got some apples. They ship apples down from Europe because the bonobos love them so much. And you'll see what happens when you throw some apples into a... Yeah. So that gives you a taste of what we're talking about with the bonobos. Franz Duval tells a story about how bonobos kiss. They tongue kiss. And... he went to Holland, where he had done a lot of his research. 15 years, he hadn't been there. He went back and one of the bonobos recognized him. I guess a lot of them did, but one of the females that he was really close with. And he went up next to the cage and was talking with her and touching her, and she reached out and grabbed him behind the head and stuck her tongue in his mouth. And bonobos are like 5 times the strength of humans. So if a bonobo wants to kiss you, he or she is going to kiss you, so get used to that.
Im D-Radio-Wissen-Hörsaal geht es heute um die Frage, was an der Sexualität des Menschen von der Natur angelegt ist und was kulturell bedingt ist. Der Psychologe und Autor Christopher Ryan spricht darüber, und zwar stellt er die zentralen Eckpunkte seines Buches Sex at Dawn vor. Das hat er gemeinsam mit seiner Frau Cecilia Jetta geschrieben und es hat in den USA sehr viel Resonanz bekommen und ziemlich für Diskussionen gesorgt. Gleich geht es damit weiter. In der zweiten Hälfte des Vortrags hat das Mikrofon leider streckenweise etwas geschwächelt. Bitte entschuldigt das. Ryan ist aber noch sehr gut zu verstehen.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
This is just a photograph that reminds me to say something about how we're to, you know, reinforce this point that we're not saying our ancestors did not feel love. We're not saying that there were no sacred relationships. We're just saying that love and sex aren't necessarily the same thing. And there's no biological reason to believe that love and sex were the same thing for our ancestors. When previous to agriculture, we talk in the book about anthropological cases, as I said. We talk a lot about societies in the Amazon that practice something called partible paternity. Anthropologists call it that. And what that means is that fatherhood can be split up among several different men. And the way this happens is that women in these societies, by the way, these societies are spread throughout the Amazon. They're also found in Papua New Guinea, and I think some of the Australian Aboriginal societies practice this. And these societies have no interaction. There's no common language, no trading or anything. So this is an idea that sprung up independently in different parts of the world, right? And the idea is that a fetus is literally made of accumulated semen. Okay, so when a girl starts to menstruate, she's sort of about half pregnant, but she won't actually start to form a baby until she's accumulated enough semen that it starts to form into a fetus, right? So like women everywhere, she'll want her baby to be as strong and good looking and smart and funny as possible. So she'll have sex with the smart guy and the funny guy and the good looking guy and to get all those qualities into her baby. And then when she gives birth to the baby, each of those guys will come forward and say, yes, I'm one of the fathers. So fatherhood becomes like a group activity in these societies. And anthropologists have studied the survival rates of the children that have multiple fathers versus the children that only have one recognized father. And they find that the children with multiple fathers do indeed survive much, much more often than the children with only one father. So again, this is contrary to the standard narrative, which holds that a man has to know that that's his child because otherwise he won't invest in that child. That's not the way it really plays out in the field. And again, this is a very economic, if you think about all this investment, right? It's a very economic concept. And it's based in the modern world. It's based on a zero-sum world where if you have more, that means I have less. But that's not the way economics works in a hunter-gatherer society, right? There's enough for everyone. It's all out there. We just have to go and get it, right? We talk about a great example, another society. I think it's the Kulina. There's a ritual called the, I don't know how to pronounce it, but the women go around in the morning. They'll decide, okay, these guys are lazy. They don't go hunting. We haven't had any meat in a while. So in the morning, they get up and they go around the village and they sing a song that roughly translates to, you guys are lazy. We haven't had any meat in a long time. Get out of your hammocks and, you know, get us some meat. And I wrote to the anthropologist who lived with these people and I said, does meat have a double significance for them? He said, yes, yeah, they know what they mean. They're joking. So while they're singing this song, they go around to the different huts and the different hammocks. And a woman will go up and beat on the hut or on the hammock post of the man to signify that if that man comes home with some meat that night, she'll sleep with him, right? And she only hits the post of a guy she's not currently sleeping with. So it's to motivate him, right? And if the guy really doesn't want to sleep with her, he can pretend he's got stomach problems or whatever. You know, he can get out of it. But most of them will get up and they go, oh, okay. And the anthropologist describes it beautifully, how, you know, they sort of glum and, oh, we'll go hunting, okay. And then they go out. But before they split up to hunt for the monkeys, they agree to meet at a certain point at a certain time before they go back into the village. So then they'll split off, they go hunt the monkeys. Some guys will kill a monkey, most of them won't. Then they come back, they meet, they split up the monkeys so that every guy goes back into the village with a piece of meat. So everybody gets laid. Yeah. At the end of the, it's a very dry anthropological paper, and at the end he says, the Kulina practice this ritual quite often and in high spirits. Bet they do. So this, of course, brings us to the question of sperm competition. Yeah, now there's a great debate going on as to whether sperm competition happens in human beings or not. I think it's a silly debate because every ejaculate contains hundreds of millions of sperm, only one of which could possibly make it to the egg. That's a competitive environment. Right? That is in itself a competitive environment. So the question of sperm competition is only saying, well, is it, you know, 300 million to one or a billion to one? Is it only the 300 million sperm of the one man, or are there sperm from other men involved? Casilda and I think it's quite obvious that humans evolved in the context of sperm competition between several men. Darwin also was interested in this, as he says here, no case interested and perplexed me so much as the brightly colored hinder ends of adjoining parts of certain monkeys. He meant apes. In those days, they didn't distinguish between the two. By the way, everyone knows the difference between monkeys and apes. Monkeys have tails. Apes don't have tails. That's easy to remember. So here you see a sexual swelling of a chimpanzee. Now, the reason Darwin was perplexed by this is that the Darwinian theory of sexual selection, sexual behavior, is that males are the aggressive sex. Males are out there trying to get as much sex as possible, and the females are sitting back and saying, I'm not so interested in this, you're going to have to convince me, what's in it for me? So he couldn't understand why the females would be advertising their ovulation. It's not necessary. The males would want to have it anyway, right? So why would the females be teasing them this way? And of course, Darwin thought this was all very far from any human behavior. Although, again, you know, that's sort of like the squirrel with the big balls to me. And, you know, I look at that and I see sexual swellings, of course. And, you know, although it's funny that in the Victorian time it was very important to cover your ankles so that men didn't get excited. But you have the big, yeah. And now, lest you think this is isolated in Victorian era, let me introduce you to the butt bra. This is something I came across online, don't ask me how. And researching this book was very interesting, let me tell you. And I wrote to the company, I said, you know, I'm writing this book and maybe a picture of a butt bra would be great in the book. I thought they'd say, you know, get lost. But they were really nice, and they said, oh yeah, just, you know, which model do you prefer? We'll send you a high-res picture. So Cassie and I spent an evening looking at the butt bra models, and she's our favorite. Another website I came across in my research took close-up photos. Each page there was a close-up photo, two close-up photos. One was of this region. I don't know what you call it in German. In English, it's the plumber's crack. And then the other photo was of a woman's breasts together. And you had to guess which was which. It's impossible to tell the difference. They look the same. Now, there's a theory that the reason women have pendulous breasts is purely as sexual signaling device. Because as we know, the fatty deposits in women's breasts have no correlation to their ability to lactate, right? And most animals have no fatty deposits at all. Among primates, there's one other primate that has fatty deposits in the breasts. And interestingly, it also is an upright primate. It's the Gelada baboon in Ethiopia who stand upright. So the theory is that sexual swellings in humans shifted from the genitalia when we became upright because it was just too much trouble to walk with all that, you know, between our legs. So now, we don't only talk about women's bodies in the book, we also talk about men's bodies, male bodies. Yes, the Italian is a friend of ours, I'm happy to say. These two photos I took. This woman is in Holland, a warm, beautiful spring day, gorilla lying out enjoying the sun, relaxed as can be. A gorilla's testicles are the size of kidney beans, and a full-grown gorilla's penis is the size of your pinky finger. Erect, okay? The Italian, on the other hand, took this picture in India. Funny story, this guy lived in India 20 years, and he's a very interesting guy. He just sort of goes around the world and finds exotic pieces of wood and stones, and then he'll make some amazing piece of art and sell it for 10,000 euros and then just travel for another year. And he's like a sort of a Jesus figure or something. And so I started using this photo in presentations, just assuming he wouldn't mind. And then one day I was at the thing in Australia, and that went out on the web. I did an event in Australia that was pretty well, you know, seen in Asia. And apparently someone sent it to him, and I got an email from him saying, hey, what is this? You're using my photo. But he doesn't mind. He's famous now, I think. BBB, yeah. He said his friends call him BBB, Big Black Balls. Yeah. So anyway, the point is, lest we get distracted, the point is, why do gorillas have tiny little testicles and bonobos have testicles, as you can see, the size of chicken eggs, and humans somewhere in between, but definitely closer to the bonobo end of the scale? Well, the theory is that when sperm competition is taking place in a species, meaning that the females are typically having sex with more than one male in each ovulatory cycle, the evolutionary pressure is on the males to create more and stronger sperm. So they develop larger and larger testicles. Whereas in a harem-based system, like the gorilla, the competition is taking place on the level of the individual males, not on the sperm cell level, but on the individual level. So the males tend to, the adaptive pressure is on the size and strength of the individual males. So male gorillas tend to be about double the size of female gorillas, but they have very small testicles, because once the silverback expels all the other males from the group through fighting, then he's the only one who's having sex with the females, right? So there's very low level of sperm competition in gorillas, so they don't need to have big testicles and lots of sperm cells and so on. Whereas in bonobos and chimps, they do. Now this fits into our theory of social cohesion among our ancestors, because what happens is that in gorillas, because there's so much conflict between males, you end up with one male, a group of females, and the other males who lost the fight are out living in these roving bands of angry, frustrated males, right? Whereas in bonobos and chimpanzees, and we argue humans, you have much larger social groups that have to accommodate all these different males. If men are fighting over women all the time, how are you possibly going to have a socially cohesive group that's interdependent, taking care of each other, sharing food, sharing defense, sharing medical care, all these things that we know our ancestors did? That's the only reason we survived. So this, you know, this is all seems like it's about sex, but it's really about much more than sex. It's about social organization. So this chart shows, you know, the different size between the males and females, the body size dimorphism. As you see here, the gorilla female is much smaller, orangutan as well. Now, gibbons are the only ostensibly monogamous ape. It's actually, some subspecies have been found to not be as monogamous as scientists had thought. But with monogamous apes and mammals in general, what you tend to find is that they are almost indistinguishable. You don't have these big size differences like you do with the gorilla and the orangutan. Now, this shows the size of the testicle relative to the overall body size, whether it's an external testicle or an internal testicle, as with the gorilla, and also the size of the penis. The human, you'll all be happy to hear, has by far the thickest penis of any primate, and probably the longest, although maybe the bonobo and the human tie for the longest relative to body size. Okay? The other thing about the human penis that's very interesting is the shape, right? You've got this flared head. Now, that, as you saw with the bonobos, their penis is not shaped like that at all. Bonobo sex and chimp sex is intromission, ejaculation, that's the end of the story. This in and out, thrusting, repeated thrusting motion that's characteristic of human sex is human sex. And together with the flared head of the human penis, what happens is all that thrusting creates a vacuum in the female that pulls down any sperm or semen that's already in her. So this is another adaptation to sperm competition. Another, I mean, I could go on all night just about this particular Dan Savage, I don't know if you know who Dan Savage is, he's an American writer, he calls this the plunger penis because of the moving, the repeated movement. Another interesting thing, just while we're talking about sperm competition, is the first spurt of the male ejaculate contains a chemical that is corrosive to any other sperm cells it encounters. The middle spurts contain most of the sperm cells, and then the last spurt contains a protective chemical that protects against the first spurt from someone else, right? These things don't evolve by accident, right? Another thing that doesn't come into the chart at all, but why do females have multiple orgasms? Why can the human female have multiple orgasms? Why is she slower to become aroused, but once she's aroused can go all night, where guys get aroused like that, and once they have an orgasm, they want to go, you know, watch a football match. What? That doesn't make sense if we evolved in these monogamous couples, that we evolved such differing sexual agendas or modus operandi. So anyway, these are all things we talk about in the book. Now sometimes, we were speaking earlier, people think that ours is a book of advocacy, but that just means they haven't read it. We don't advocate anything. And sometimes people say, well, you know, life's not that simple. You know, you're saying everyone should have an open relationship, blah, blah, blah. Life's not that simple. Well, someone who's involved in open relationships made up this chart and sent it to me. This is just some of the, you know, different configurations of non-traditional, so-called non-traditional relationships that you could get into. What we're arguing in the book is that monogamy is like vegetarianism, right? You can choose to be a vegetarian, and it can be a very healthy choice. It can be ethical and, you know, healthy and economically better, but don't expect it to be easy, right? Just because you've chosen to become a vegetarian doesn't mean that bacon suddenly stops smelling good, right? And so if you understand that, if you understand that the trajectory of the species is toward a different kind of behavior, then you can choose what to do with better expectations of what sort of challenges you'll face. So thank you very much, and we can do some Q&A.
Monogamie ist wie Vegetarismus. Vielleicht besser für dich, aber nicht zwingend eine einfache Lebensweise. Aha. Dessen soll man sich bewusst sein, sagt Christopher Ryan, Psychologe, Autor und Erforscher der Ursprünge moderner Sexualität. Wir hörten seinen Vortrag Sex at Dawn, in dem er im Einstein Forum Potsdam am 28. November 2012 die zentralen Thesen seines gleichnamigen Buches vorgestellt hat, das er gemeinsam mit seiner Frau, der Psychiaterin Cecilia Jetta, geschrieben hat. Ja, und nach so einem Vortrag ist ziemlich klar, es gibt Diskussionsstoff. Im Einstein Forum ist es gute Tradition, dass zu einem Vortrag auch eine anschließende Diskussion gehört. Und weil dieses Thema so essentiell die Grundlagen unserer Gesellschaft und unsere Normen berührt, hören wir morgen ausnahmsweise keinen weiteren Vortrag, sondern die anschließende Frage- und Antwortrunde, in der Ryan seine Thesen noch weiter erklärt und mit anschaulichen Beispielen untermauert hat. Bis dann.
D-Radio Wissen. D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.